Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today. First, Josh Bivens, co-author of The State of Working America. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from the writer Melissa Jarrett Grant about sex workers and their self-appointed saviors. Very little time for news headlines today. Just a couple of very quick points. The August employment report was a serious disappointment, with the pace of job growth slowing and the labor force shrinking. This is yet another sign of an economy in deep structural crisis. The teacher strike in Chicago is an inspiring and wonderful thing. I'll have more about it next week, but for now I'll say that unlike many other public sector unions, the Chicago Teachers Union is doing not only to protect their wages and working conditions, but to improve the quality of schooling and fight the barbaric testing and privatization agenda. Okay, first up, Josh Bivens. Josh is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and co-author of their State of Working America, which is published every couple of years. On Wednesday, we learned that last year, average incomes continued to fall, the poverty rate remained flat, and the number of those without health insurance declined slightly. This is only the latest in a long string of bad news. Here's Josh Bivens to tell us more. Welcome, Josh. We all know that the Great Recession and the weak recovery that's followed it has been pretty hellish on average incomes, but the 30 years that went before that weren't so great either, right? So give us some background into what things looked like for the broad swath of Americans before the Great Recession hit.
So in the sort of immediate economic recovery before the Great Recession hit, say between 2000 and 2007, you basically had no income growth for, say, median income of working age families. And so basically that entire early 2000s expansion and recovery, no income growth. And then, as you note, you know, those incomes fall off the cliff starting in the Great Recession. So kind of we're already working on a lost decade of income growth. In the 30 years before that, you basically had very, very sluggish growth except for one brief good period in the late 1990s when labor markets got genuinely tight.
Yeah, what was unusual about the late 90s?
What was most unusual is that unemployment reached well below what people had claimed beforehand you could actually get to without sparking inflation. And so we actually saw an unemployment rate of, I think, 3.8% for a month in the late 90s, and we saw an extended 4% unemployment rate, which was a lot lower than people thought the Fed would ever be willing to tolerate. When they finally did tolerate it, we actually saw some good across-the-board wage growth.
And across the board really means across the board. It was like every income level, every gender, every race. It was pretty universal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you just said, you pick a labor market indicator and look at the series, and basically you see a lot of stagnation except for the late 1990s where employment rates were up, unemployment rates were down, wage growth was up. So pretty much it's everywhere you look in the labor market, things were better in the late 90s.
And then we had the crash and recession of the early 2000s, and all that was over.
Yes, all that was over. Again, you know, we had that lost decade of median income growth. Yeah, I'd also like to emphasize just, you know, we've got that lost decade already, and if you look at projections for what unemployment is going to be over, say, the next 6 or 7 years, you know, people don't have us getting back down to reliable 5% unemployment until something like 2017, 2018. We probably have another lost decade that's already in the pipeline unless we do something pretty radically different in trying to drive down unemployment.
Yeah, I want to get to that at the end of this, but let's just review some of the, I hesitate to call them highlights, lowlights, of the scene. First of all, employment over the last few years has been absolutely dismal. It collapsed in the Great Recession, but the recovery has been remarkably weak, right?
It has been. I mean, I would say it's been actually, by some measures, the current recovery is slightly better than the recovery from the 2001 recession, which is by far the worst on record. But of course, the hole left by the preceding recession is so much deeper that it feels much worse. But by any stretch, yeah, I mean, if you look at some measures, if you don't look at jobs, if you look at like rates, say the employment to population ratio of prime age workers 25 to 54, what you see there is it absolutely falls off a cliff as the recession starts. It stops falling at some point in the late, say, 2009, early 2010, and then we've made almost no progress in dragging it back up. We've basically just plateaued at a new lower level.
And the job growth that we've seen has been pretty skewed towards lower wage occupations, hasn't it?
It has. The National Employment Law Project actually just had a pretty new report coming out in the last week, and basically most of the employment growth has been skewed toward the sort of the occupations that pay in the bottom third of wages, and so that does seem to be the case. And that's It's actually a pretty common one. As the economy, you know, comes out of a recession and goes into recovery, wages take a long time to start coming back up.
And so, you know, put all these things together, over the last several decades, you know, 30 years or more, we've seen stagnant to declining incomes for pretty much everybody except the very top, right?
That's about right. We take a really long look at this in the income chapter of the book because there is this kind of revisionist literature going on that's claiming the middle actually did okay if you add up things like government-provided health benefits and employer-provided health benefits and other comprehensive measures of income. If you look at those measures, basically they grew by about 19%. This is for the middle fifth in the income distribution. Incomes grew by about 19% between 1979 and 2007, so barely over a half percentage point per year, which is pretty bad in and of itself. And then the vast majority of that growth can actually be explained by sort of Social Security and Medicare. Much bigger contribution to growth for middle-income families over that period than, say, wage growth. And so if you want to look at, you know, the sources of economic strength or the only bright spots for middle-income families over that time period, you should look at the social insurance programs. Wages have contributed very, very little to that growth.
And you have an analysis of healthcare's contribution to the illusion of rising incomes. You apply a healthcare deflator. Tell us what that does.
Exactly. So that 19% income growth at the middle, we argue that some of that is miscounted because it is essentially the way this comes from the CBO, Congressional Budget Office data, and they take contributions made by employers for healthcare premiums as well as Medicare and Medicaid, but they deflate those payments by the overall inflation measure, the CPI-URS, and we argue that you should instead deflate those by a medical care specific deflator. Basically, healthcare has seen much faster price increases than the rest of the economy. And we think that's right to do because if you look at like the CPI, actually the overall one doesn't even include employer provided health premiums. And so they're just not being picked up anywhere in the measure that CBO is using. You deflate by the healthcare specific one that takes into account the fact that healthcare prices have risen so quickly. A full third of that income growth, that 19% income growth between 79 and 2007, is knocked off. So just that one technical adjustment to account for very fast income growth knocks that income growth figure down to 12% over that entire period.
And there's been quite a contrast with various age groupings, right? The over 65s have been doing fairly well because of Social Security's cost of living adjustments, but people in the really young brackets are doing quite poorly, aren't they?
They are. If you look at sort of the, again, you know, we kind of decomposed the sources of income growth over the last, the 28 years before the recession, and it's basically Social Security, Medicare, and pensions are providing, God, I think it's more than 80% of the income growth over that period, and those are all directed at elderly retired households. I mean, the way someone has put it is, you know, that they're the legacies of the social democracy of the past that is not something that I'm particularly really confident is going to be boosting income growth over the next 30 years or so.
And let's just be clear on this, because they've been relatively insulated, you don't want to take it away from them.
Absolutely. I mean, if I see one portion of income that is doing really well and actually providing some growth to those in the middle, it seems to me the last thing you should do is start going after it.
The stagnant income picture is, I think, familiar to a lot of people, as is inequality. But give us some sense of what's happened to inequality over the last three decades or so.
Pretty much, it's risen shockingly. I mean, no matter how you look at it, no matter what measure you use, and it's also pretty unbelievable how important it is to look at the very, very narrow slice at the top. There's some data sources like the Census Bureau, and they do something that's called top coding of very high incomes. You know, because it's publicly released data, and for confidentiality reasons, they don't report the precise income at very high levels. And so they just sort of cap it at some top code. And so you don't really know what's going on above that. Sources, data sources that are top-coded actually show much less inequality, though still a lot, but much less than those that have access to the full confidential data beneath, which means those at the very, very, very top, sort of out of sight of publicly available data sources, they are doing unbelievably well in pulling up the entire sort of analysis of income inequality. And so one of those sources that's not top-coded, you know, the Congressional Budget Office releases data, it's got income, it includes everything. Government benefits, capital gains, employer-provided health care. And in that data set, for example, you know, you've got the middle group that's seen 19% growth between 1979 and 2007. Top 1% has seen 241% growth over that same period. So that pattern, if not quite that magnitude, it's just replicated no matter how you cut it.
And the 99 versus 1% meme is perhaps an oversimplification, but it's pretty well grounded in reality, isn't it?
It really is. To be precise, you might want to bring it down to the top 3.5% or something like that. But it's absolutely true. I mean, even if you look at the say, 90 to 95th percentile of total incomes in the CBO data, and you compare that to the economy-wide average, they just barely get the economy-wide average growth over that time period. So basically, you have to be at the 90th percentile to even be enjoying income growth that matches overall productivity. So that's doing better than everyone below you, but it's hard to say, you know, you're having some huge bonanza. So yeah, the degree to which the inequality has been concentrated in that very narrow slice of the top is really shocking.
So it's really not an exaggeration to say that almost all the benefits of income growth over the last several decades, perhaps with the exception of the late 90s, has gone to the top 5 to 10% of the population.
Yeah, I don't think that's an exaggeration. I mean, we do one thing. We look at wealth data, and we look at the growth in wealth between 1983 and 2010, and we pick those years because Survey of Consumer Finance only comes out every 3 years, and so you have to take the endpoints you're given. But you look at the growth in wealth over that time period, 75% of the growth in wealth goes to the top 5% of households in that time period. The bottom 60% have wealth declines over that entire period.
I was speaking with Josh Bivens of the Economic Policy Institute, one of the co-authors of their excellent and indispensable State of Work in America, 2012 edition. Since the bulk of middle-income wealth comes from housing, I imagined they've gotten hammered by the housing bust.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the change from 2007 to 2010, which is like the two data points we have, they're basically housing price peak, then factoring in the crash, you see the median wealth took a hit of, I think, over 45% in those 3 years alone, whereas wealth at the very top, it actually did take a hit because by 2010 the stock market was still down relative to 2007 and some others, but nowhere near as much, in the range of about 12%. So yeah, the fact that middle-income households, if they have wealth, it is overwhelmingly concentrated in their home. They got really hammered by the housing bubble burst.
And then moving down the ladder, people in the bottom quarter or a third of the population have virtually no wealth to speak of. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. I think, you know, that there's about 15% of households that have negative net worth, and then you've got another pretty significant chunk that have zero, and then if you're talking about less than, say, $5,000 or $10,000, it is a good third of all households. That's right.
And now we've been speaking of high incomes and wealth, but poverty. Aside from the late 90s, when poverty declined rather dramatically, it's been flat or rising for a good bit of the last several decades, right?
That's right. It was actually rising before the Great Recession began. It actually rose between 2000 and 2007. And then, as you say, you know, and then it's sort of spiked up a lot in the aftermath of the Great Recession. We'll actually have 2011 poverty numbers come out, I think, on Wednesday. And some things to look at, I think one thing that hasn't gotten enough attention, if you look at deep poverty, which is the share of people who make less than half of the official poverty threshold, that actually reached its highest point ever in 2010. And so, yeah, except for the period in the late 1990s, there's really been no progress at all. I mean, not no progress at all, it kind of bounces up and down with the business cycle, but shockingly little progress since the middle 1970s in driving down the overall poverty rate.
And this is a little arcane for radio, but the American poverty line is a constant concept, right? We're talking about essentially the same purchasing power as a poverty income in 1960.
That's right. It's an absolute threshold. So in an economy that has grown, say, on a per capita basis of about 80% since the early 1970s, it really should not have been that hard to make substantial progress in pushing poverty down. We do one exercise in the book that is, there's really good progress in fighting poverty between 1959, which is one of our earliest data points, and the early 1970s. And basically, if you just do a statistical association of growth in GDP per capita and poverty, you get a really strong relationship. GDP per capita goes up, poverty goes down. If you actually extended that relationship that held between 1959 and the mid-1970s forward, and if that continued to hold, you'd have actually seen, you know, poverty essentially eradicated by about the mid-1980s. But, of course, that relationship completely broke down some point in the middle 1970s, and that was when poverty stopped reliably going down at all.
Yeah, I want to return to this topic in a moment, but let's just discuss a couple of the classic gaps, gender and race gaps. What's been happening to the gender gap in income over the last, recently, first of all, but put that in longer-term context?
So the gender wage gap is one of the few things that sort of bucks the trend of gloom and doom for a lot of this period. There's definitely been progress in pushing the gap between average wages of men and women, even when you account for, say, education and labor market experience and things like that. It's still not one-to-one. I actually don't remember off the top of my head what the current gender wage gap is, but it's still an adjusted gap of just under 10%. So a woman with the same education, labor market experience, all that still makes less money than a similar male worker. But that's one of the few sort of things that doesn't fit the picture of just clear decline over the past couple of decades.
Although some of that has come from stagnation in male incomes, not necessarily great growth in female, right?
That's right. I mean, if you just look at sort of the average, not the average, if you take the median wage of men versus women, there's been a very quick convergence. Part of that is because the median male wage from 1979 is essentially flat over that time period. And so a lot of that gain is, like you say, just gaining on a stagnant male wage. And you see the same thing even more starkly in if you look at things like employer-provided health insurance or pension coverage. You've seen male-female gaps close a lot in those measures, but those have been driven perhaps more by men losing coverage rather than women just gaining that much more quickly.
And race gaps, those are not closing with anything like the speed of the gender gap.
Definitely not. I mean, like you said before, the late 1990s actually saw some of the best growth in relative incomes of African Americans relative to white households. And so, again, that late 1990s period, a lot of good things happened. Since then, they've drifted back apart. If you look at things, you know, to me, where it's really stark is the employer-provided benefits, both health insurance and pension coverage. You've seen those gaps just fly apart. And so, for example, in 1979, the gap in health insurance coverage between Latino households and white households was about 20 percentage points. It was in the 60s for white households, and it was in the 40s for Latino. Now white households are three times more likely to have employer-provided health insurance than they were before.
So let's turn to some of the structural issues that might be driving this. You mentioned earlier that there was a breakdown in the relationship between economic growth and poverty reduction, but there does seem to be a breakdown in the relationship between economic growth and just general welfare as well. What's happened?
Yeah, if you look at business cycle peaks, which is how economists like to look at kind of long-run trends, you know, the break really happens after the 1979 business cycle peak. And what we try to argue in the book, and we try to argue a little more explicitly than we have in past volumes, in the past we've stuck a little too much to the, or stuck a lot to the, this is a just the facts kind of reference book. In our overview chapter, we try to connect, you know, there's some really obvious dots here. If you think about what happened post-1979, we undertook just a number of intentional policy decisions that were going to have the really predictable effect of increasing inequality and making it harder for low and middle wage workers to see wage increases. And so in the 1980s, we allowed the minimum wage to be not adjusted for inflation for a full decade. And predictably, wages at the bottom end of the labor market absolutely cratered. For a lot of the 1980s and early 1990s, we had a Federal Reserve that targeted unemployment rates that were far too high, even relative to their goal of keeping inflation, you know, substantially in check. And we show in the book that those high rates of unemployment are damaging to everyone. They're particularly damaging to workers at the low end and the middle income. And then there's also we think a big part of the story is the failure to reform labor law to allow it to keep pace with growing employer hostility to organizing efforts. And so that deunionization not only affects workers who are no longer in a union, so they take a wage hit from that. We also argue that unions provide sort of wage norms across industries and across geographic areas, and we have research that shows that probably about a third of some inequality measures over this entire period can be associated with the decline in unionization. And then a range of other things too. Deregulation in some sectors like trucking sort of hammered wages at the middle, while deregulation in sectors like finance helped those at the very top claim an ever greater share of economic growth. And so we think once you look at the accumulated effect of all these clear, intentional policy decisions, there's actually not much mystery left over in regards to why inequality rose so much.
And to explain the wage stagnation of the 70s and 80s, and even into the early 90s, people would talk about a stagnation in productivity growth, but productivity accelerated in the mid-90s and has stayed pretty strong since, even over the last few years. So that explanation doesn't work. How do we break the relationship between productivity and wages?
I think basically we tilted the playing field so that workers at the low and bottom end of the wage scale low and middle end of the wage scale just had a lot of bargaining power taken from them, whether through deunionization, whether through the declining value of the minimum wage, whether through accelerating global integration with a much poorer global economy on terms that put our frontline workers in direct competition with workers everywhere else but provided plenty of protection for our international investors. I think basically the common theme and lots of the policies that were passed that helped break that link between productivity and wage growth was we tried to shove as much bargaining power away from the low and middle as we could and give it to the top, and I think we got exactly the results you would expect.
One explanation for inequality and even economic stagnation is education, there's a higher return to skill, and the education gap explains a lot of the growth in inequality. What do you make of that?
We think that's really – there's far too much emphasis on that, especially in regards to the sort of policy discussions. I mean, one of the things we point out is that it's true that in the 80s and early 90s, you did see a rising college wage premium, so that the extra wage boost you get from getting a BA, that was rising in the 80s and 90s. You know, we should point out, you know, that's going to rise if the top 1 in 5% just start claiming more and more, because the top 1 in 5% are – obviously overwhelmingly going to have college degrees. But it doesn't mean that it was by itself driven by some rising return to a college education. Since 1995, the college wage premium has pretty much flattened out. I mean, if you look at the average wage of college graduates from, say, 2002 until 2011, pretty much flat, even as productivity continues to grow. So I think a lot of that story about, you know, the centrality of getting a college degree, at least it had some plausibility in the 80s and early 90s where there really was a rising college wage premium. After 1995, there's nothing there at all. I think even the earlier period, it was actually just college graduates getting swept up in the general top 1 in 5%. But over the past, what is it, it's almost 12 years now. I mean, there's just very little, or almost 15 years now, there's very little evidence to say that what the economy is telling us is that we need many more college graduates, because those college graduate wages are actually pretty flat over that period.
And finally, I always leave the what is to be done question for when there's a couple of minutes left, but what's the way out of this, at least some sense of how we can get people to work and get incomes rising again?
Yeah, I think the most immediate goal should be attacking the unemployment problem. I think that things, I mean, to me, we have a pretty classic Keynesian downturn right now. There's not enough demand. There's not enough spending by households, government, and businesses to employ everybody who's willing to work. And so the solution to not enough spending is more spending. The most reliable way to get more spending out there would be, you know, call it fiscal stimulus, fiscal support, more spending by the government on infrastructure, on income transfers, all sorts of things. I think we all know the prospects for that are pretty bleak in the near term, but that is the most reliable thing that could pull down the unemployment rate quickly, and that's the number one thing we could do to help wage growth in the near term. In the longer term, you know, to steal a phrase from sort of the climate change people about what needs to be done, there's no silver bullet, there's just silver buckshot. And so it's basically realize all the different ways that economic policies you might not think have a lot to do with inequality really do have a lot to do with inequality. So when the Fed targets an unemployment rate, you know, back when they can actually hit their unemployment target, when that happens again in the future, when they target an unemployment rate too high to keep inflation in check, that's not only bad for the economy because it keeps unemployment too high, it also leads directly to inequality. The minimum wage, we should raise that to at least its historic high level, which would put it right around $10, and then index it so it doesn't continue to lose value over time unless Congress acts. And so I think it's just sort of a range of policy levers that we need to start pulling to restore some of the bargaining power to low and middle income workers that have been lost over the past 30 years.
That was Josh Bivens, a staff economist for the Economic Policy Institute, talking about their State of Working America. You can find it online at stateofworkingamerica.org, stateofworkingamerica.org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break. I'm a son of Marion Faithful during Working Class Hero. Next up, Melissa Jira Grant. Melissa is a former sex worker who is now a prolific writer and web personality. She objects to all the self-appointed saviors of sex workers like Nick Kristof of the New York Times. Here she is to say why. Welcome, Melissa. So take us back to the 70s, the days of the happy hooker. We forgot that, huh?
Before my birth, so, you know, reaching outside my depth, but certainly, you know, that memory of, well, first of all, like the swinging 70s, right, which I miss this moment in the sexual revolution where we were having all this optimism about women's sexuality. You can't talk about the happy hooker without putting it in that context. And, you know, what we're like a year or two before Roe v. Wade, like this is an optimistic moment. You would think that all different kinds of people who are invested in women's sexual rights and autonomy will be coming together and celebrating what women are doing to take control of their lives. But where I am excited about the happy hooker, even whatever, however many years out this is I keep hearing people in their efforts to, you know, put down sex work or to say that sex workers have no control over their lives, use her as this fantasy figure, you know, like, well, there aren't that many happy hookers or happy hookers don't really exist. And I don't know, I think it's fascinating that something that started as, you know, kind of a sexploitation memoir is now, like, you hear it in policy conversations. How did we get there? How did this thing that the New York Times thought was, you know, a piece of trash, which not that that's anything, but the fact that they had to weigh in that it was a piece of trash is fascinating. And it still has this sway on the imagination. There are these very few special sex workers over here who are happy, and then, you know, the vast majority who are not. I don't think that that's true.
It's impossible to imagine a book being published now with that title, though.
No, it would have to be the, you know, happy until she realized she wasn't really happy hooker or something like that. The happy until Nick Kristof came along and saved her and realized that she was oppressed hooker.
Yeah, so let's talk about Nick Kristof. He has some fans. Perhaps some of them are even listening to this show. But, you know, he is one of the more prominent representatives of this rescue movement who think that sex workers are just suffering horribly and need to be saved by imperialist men from abroad.
So, coming in with the full force of, you know, local law enforcement in Cambodia and Vietnam and Malaysia, you know, places where we absolutely trust the integrity of law enforcement to protect women, right? But put that aside for the moment. Here comes Nick, Saint Nick, in his little white safari hat with his phone glued to his hand so he can tweet all of his actions. I mean, this is someone who believes that advocacy for women's rights has him in a starring role. And I think that's fundamentally the issue with this.
But he's not known for talking with the women he's rescuing, is he?
Not particularly. Or he'll cast certain women that he believes are, you know, representative characters that his understanding of a Western audience might sympathize with. But generally, he's happy to speak for them without actually, you know, allowing them to have any control over, you know, what he doesn't do is what happens next, right? Like, what happens after he comes roaring into a town in a white Toyota pickup truck with all of the NGO power behind him and the local law enforcement to rescue these women and put them in these centers they call rehabilitation centers, but are actually quite more like a jail, and where there's very few services offered to these people, and quite frequently they escape and return back to sex work or some other work. He doesn't follow up on that part of it. He's only focused on the part where he can be the hero, and I think there's a huge problem with that.
Yeah, well, this is quite a developing into a large multinational industry, the rescue industry, so give us some sense of the dimensions. Who are these people and what motivates them?
one of the largest organizations working on this kind of raid and rescue approach is the International Justice Mission. They are, you know, an evangelical organization. They only hire Christians. They have workers who, you know, have little prayer meetings before they go out for the day and conduct their activities. And they describe what they're doing as saving people from slavery. They position themselves as an organization that thinks that, you know, all forced labor is a form of slavery. But they only really focus on sexual labor. And what they will do is they will, you know, in absence of robust local law enforcement and their understanding, will go in and take it upon themselves to go into a workplace or a home and remove people from it and divert them to one of the rehabilitation centers. So that's the model for which a lot of work now is done in the name of protecting people from forced labor or rescuing people from exploitative labor situations. It's assumed that cops are what you need to rescue people from a bad workplace if what's being done in that workplace is commercial sex.
But they've developed a lot of allies among people who might not be thought to be the natural allies of evangelical rescuers. So they have progressive organizations, feminist groups also getting involved. What's their angle?
I mean, their angle is anything to get women out of prostitution is better than prostitution. So you'll get an organization like Equality Now, which started in the early 90s, picking up a lot of this kind of what I think of as very vintage anti-porn, anti-prostitution ideology, that all porn and prostitution is violence against women, all sex work is always exploitative to all women everywhere, including to women who aren't doing it. So their understanding is that any existence of sex work is painful and harmful to all women. So they will look at a group like IJM and say, well, this is great. You're doing something to actually, you know, chip away at the sex industry, so we'll support what you're doing, even if your other beliefs are completely counter to anything that we might consider to be feminist. They're happy to go in for it.
Well, you know, thinking back to the days of the Mies Commission in the 80s, and, you know, there's this alliance between certain kinds of feminists and the repressive power of the state, which doesn't seem very natural on the face of it. So what's going on there?
I mean, this is a resurrection of that in many ways, right? And they didn't win there. I mean, you have things like, you know, Andrew Dworkin and Catherine McKinnon saying that because pornography is harmful to women, which they'll get allies on the right to support them in that, not because they believe in women's rights, but because they, you know, want to have some kind of control over marriage and family and home and sex that happens outside of that, including porn, is seen as a bad thing. So they'll jump on that. So, you know, you get that wave of collaboration in the 80s, and it didn't work. They weren't really able to win on that. One of the founders of Equality Now, Jessica Neuwirth, was doing part of a research study by Elizabeth Bernstein, a sociologist at Columbia, was doing on the anti-trafficking, anti-prostitution movement. She interviewed her in depth and said, you know, what happened from the 80s to this moment? She said, well, we used to call what we did anti-porn, anti-prostitution, but we couldn't win with what she called the ACLU types. And so now we call what we do human rights work and anti-trafficking work, and now we can do the same exact work on a post. So that's exactly what's happening. It's the same players. They're just doing it on a much larger scale. And now with, you know, I think a much more dangerous involvement of paramilitary operations. When you look at, you know, a New York Times reporter embedded with a, you know, a brothel raid to go in with guns and law enforcement to take people out of what they say is an oppressive work environment, it's much scarier, I think, the scope of support that they have on the left for that kind of operation. When I think if you explained it in that way, you would have to stop and think, well, wait a minute, why are we thinking that cops are the solution to exploitative working conditions?
Well, curiously though, like, for the evangelicals to be getting so deeply involved in this, in some ways prostitution, sex work, pornography are traveling companions of conventional marriage morality.
Right. It's the other half of the equation that allows them to prop up, you know, their very quote-unquote stable home lives. You know,
people have all kinds of unauthorized desires.
Right, and I honestly think most of their opposition to it, I think it would be overstating it to say, oh, this is, you know, about morality or about conservatism, that they're opposed to pornography and prostitution or sex work more broadly because it, you know, shows them a sexuality that they want to deny exists. I think it has a lot to do with rights and autonomy, that they see this as a way for not just women, but mostly women. And when they talk about their opposition to porn and prostitution, they're not talking about men and transgender people. They're really talking about women's behavior. I think they see it as a way for women to have control over their lives that they want to stop. And, you know, part of it is also it supports a very convenient sort of, you know, morality cleanup campaign that is attractive to them around abortion, around homosexuality. Like, it just, it fits of a piece with them, which is why it's so shocking to me then that feminists will go in for it. You know, the Heritage Foundation, like, puts on these anti-sex trafficking events that you'll see feminist organizations jump in and support. Why are they doing this? Why are they doing this? On the one hand, you know, they're saying we must end pornography and prostitution, and the feminists will support them on that, and then they spend the rest of their time trying to end GLBT rights or end abortion or end any kind of sexual education in schools. It's ridiculous to see how convenient these alliances are, but I don't know, I'm beyond the point where I'm surprised by them.
You've mentioned trafficking several times and forced labor. There's some rather questionable statistics around all this stuff, the number of people who are involved in forced labor, and the distinctions between forced labor of the sexual kind and the other kind get completely obscured. So give us some idea of the dimensions of this problem, or what we know about the dimensions of it.
I mean, statistics are almost impossible in this, because we're talking about the informal economy. What also makes statistics impossible to really rely on in this area is no one has an agreement. There's very little agreement on terms, what we mean by trafficking, what we mean by sexual labor. There, you'll hear this phrase, labor trafficking and sex trafficking, as if these are two distinct kinds of experiences. Like, I think it's really important to talk about all forced labor as forced labor, and not to separate out forced sexual labor as something different. I think when you see that, what people are actually saying is, this isn't real work. This is something else. The solutions to this kind of problem, to any kind of force or coercion in the sex industry, are different than the solutions you would have to force and coercion in other kinds of labor. So you'll see people playing with statistics. So the, you know, ILO will come out and say, we estimate that every year $32 billion comes from all forced labor. And then the anti-sex trafficking organizations will jump on that statistic and say that that's, you know, a statistic referring to forced sexual labor or sex trafficking. And, you know, every time I'm saying these phrases like sex trafficking and forced sexual labor, I feel like I have to put them in quotes by necessity, because they're so slippery, and they're intentionally slippery so that people can use them and use those statistics for whatever purpose they've already decided they've set about. My feeling is, if anyone's experiencing force or coercion in the workforce, that's a serious issue. And the scope of it is something we can argue about, but the reality is the solution is always coming ahead of the scope. The solution of giving more money to law enforcement to raid these workplaces, to make it dangerous for people to be involved in the sex industry, is actually what they push at the other end of those statistics. And that's where my focus is. Why have you already decided this is the solution to a problem that you're struggling to define? Doesn't it make sense to go back and think about what the problem is first?
Yeah, well, these raids remind me of what happens when the immigration authorities raid a factory. And what happens then? We don't really know what happens then, but it's just some injustice is being addressed by a raid, and then people forget.
Right. I mean, part of it is this larger shift, I think, towards what Elizabeth Bernstein calls carceral feminism, or we could call kind of carceral politics on the left, that, like, putting people in prison is a solution. Like, even people who will say that sex trafficking is, you know, this large global problem, which I'm still not sure that that's the case, they will then say things like, well, but we don't want to put the victims, you know, we don't want to put the workers in prison. What we want to do is isolate the traffickers and put them in prison. But it's very difficult to, in an informal workplace, to even figure out who is the perpetrator in these situations. And there's no opportunity to step back and say, well, what would we prefer then? Would we prefer people are so fearful of having any kind of organized workplace in the sex industry, so fearful of being labeled a pimp or a trafficker, that then people are working entirely independently without any kind of peer support, without any kind of sense of, you know, a support network of other workers? That's what happens. And then you put people into situations where they're incredibly vulnerable to somebody who really could come in and exploit them, takes over their work and says, oh, you're really scared to go work in that massage parlor because they're always getting raided by the cops, and now you want to work by yourself out of your apartment? Don't worry, I'll protect you. I'll help get you clients. And now you're in a situation where someone has given up a lot of control over their work to someone precisely because they're scared of getting picked up in one of these raids.
I'm speaking with Melissa Jarrett Grant, who is a writer on sex and trafficking and similar issues. I think a lot of vocabulary around this, the trafficking and forced labor, and even the use of the word prostituted instead of prostitute, suggests that people who use this kind of language can't believe that someone would enter sex work voluntarily. They have to be coerced into it, forced into it.
What do you make of that?
I wish that we asked people those questions about any job that they had, right? Isn't it convenient that we're only really thinking about what are the factors that make you feel coerced into this form of work when it's about sex work? I can only speak from my own experience and say that the kinds of factors that made me feel forced into sex work were student loan debt, healthcare bills. Those are the things that made me feel like this is something that I should do for a living in order to survive. I would love to pose that question to people who, you know, are running these evangelical anti-trafficking projects. What forced you to take up this line of work? What coerced you? What are the external factors that
made it
necessary?
Well, they're saving souls for Jesus, though.
Right. And they'll describe what they're doing as missionary as if it's in the name of some greater cause, that, you know, it just being a paycheck isn't enough. It's so frustrating to me. And it seems to reveal such a deeply patronizing attitude about people who are, you know, honestly struggling working people. Like, most people in the sex industry are not making a lot of money. Like, it's very much a service industry job on par with other service industry jobs. We don't ever go in to save the waitress. That's not what's going on here. And so I think it's as much about patronizing attitudes towards working women as it is about sexuality and a misunderstanding of what, you know, what it means to put a dollar amount on a sexual act. When we don't say, I can't believe that you offer childcare to children that are not your children. Like, that's such a violation of the intimate relationship that people have with children. Or I can't believe you're making food for someone that's not your family. That's such a violation of such an intimate activity. And, you know, some people absolutely could not imagine having sex with someone that isn't the person that they love and adore and intend to be with for the rest of their life, no matter how much of a fantasy that might be. And I think what gets lost in this conversation is people say, well, how could you ever do it? Because I would never do it. And I don't think that that's the right question. I think the question is, what are the circumstances in which you're doing this? And you have power to take control of your labor. And you're more the expert on this than I am. You know, how many people can legitimately say in the United States today, I have power over my labor? That's the question, right? That's the legitimate question.
Yeah, about 80% of the workforce is what they call non-supervisory, meaning they take orders. You know, they have no control over their workplace, effectively. But, you know, from your experience personally, from people you've talked with, worked with, do sex workers feel unusually miserable and exploited compared to other workers?
Let's see. Compared to nonprofit work that I've done? Compared to work I've done as a journalist, where I have to invoice many weeks after I have performed the labor in order to be paid for the labor? I mean, it's the way that our work is organized for us versus the ways that we have power over organizing our work for ourselves, I think, is really what it comes down to. And for me, as a sex worker, I was a freelancer. And so I look at it much more on par with any of the other freelance work that I ever did. Could I choose my clients? Could I choose to slow down work when I needed to take more time off for myself? Could I reject clients that I didn't feel good about? Yes, I had all of that choice. And that choice was absolutely mediated through the circumstances that I, you know, brought to that work. Like, you know, I had a college education. I'm someone who had the expectation that I could have control over my work. You know, I thought that sex work for me was secondary work. I always had something else going on so that I wasn't 100% reliant on that work, which I would encourage any freelancer to do. You don't want to just have one source of income. That makes you incredibly reliant on clients that are fickle and or terrible sometimes. So I never focused on the relationship with my clients to be the place that I felt exploited or vulnerable. It was much more when I walk outside the door, am I worried about getting arrested? Or when I go into a health clinic to get services, am I fearful of disclosing to them that I do sex work, that they might treat me differently? That's what's difficult about sex work, not what happens behind closed doors with a client.
I'm sure there are people listening to this who think that, you know, there's something uniquely degrading about it because it's the degradation of women. It's they make a feminist argument against this line of work, forgetting that there are male sex workers as well. But, you know, bracketing that, like, what do you say to that argument that this, you know, it's part of the system of patriarchy to subordinate women?
I mean, it seems like it's ascribing this very magical value to the vagina, which I'm sure Naomi Wolf would have opinions about after this week, that, like, there's only so much value that a woman's sexuality or a woman's body or a woman, and we're going to conflate women's sexuality, woman's body, and woman all into one heap. has, and that if you use it in the wrong way, that something is being taken away from you. That's what I hear at the core of that argument, that there's a certain way to have sex correctly, there's a certain way to relate to people sexually, there's a certain way to be in the world as a sexual being that is correct and not correct. And that seems to be at the core of that kind of argument. There's no way I can understand someone saying, you, having been a sex worker, take something away from me as a woman who's not been a sex worker, without having to go into that line of argument. You know, when you shared a story that I wrote recently on Facebook, and one of the commenters responded saying that you sharing the story somehow made you complicit in viewing women as, what was it, toilets for leftists to wank to?
Yes.
I'm not sure.
Yes.
And, you know, putting aside for the fact that I was the one who wrote the story, that, you know, she's marshaling this argument that you are a terrible person, you even, you know, saying we should consider these issues, is you saying that women are toilets. There's only one person in this conversation calling women toilets. And it's the one who's deeply upset that women might be perceived that way.
Well, she correctly perceived I was endorsing your point.
Right.
Which was my sin.
But it's fascinating to me that the, and you know, you saw this in the 80s with the Dworkins and the McKinnons and that kind of school of feminism, that this obsessive need to talk about the degradation of women, at what point does that create the degradation of women in places where there was no degradation? You know, I, in college, worked at a rape crisis center, and I did community workshops on sexual violence, gender roles. We even had a porn workshop, and I loved giving the porn workshop because I got to throw out the curriculum they handed me and do it my own way. And I went back to my boss at the Rape Crisis Center after a really great workshop where one of the students I was talking to about porn really got in my face, and he was like, haven't you heard of Susie Bright? And I was like, of course I've heard of Susie Bright. That's why I'm doing this workshop. Like, I do believe there's a possibility for porn outside this very narrow, very sexist kind of commercial porn. Most media is narrow, sexist, and overly commercial. So why would we think porn would be any different? So I wanted to have that kind of conversation about porn. So I went back to the Rape Crisis Center.
But sex is sacred, you know.
Well, right. And we definitely shouldn't look at it, or anyone doing it. So I went back to my boss, the Rape Crisis Center, and I said, I had this great conversation, and, you know, why don't we do workshops like this? Like, why are we showing people these images from Hustler from the 70s and telling people that the only thing that's changed about porn in the last 20 years is the hairstyle? This is completely ignoring people's experience. Like, we need to have a broader conversation. And her response to me was, because I had done porn, I had false consciousness, and I didn't really understand my own exploitation, and I wasn't a suitable person to give the workshop. So here we are in this moment where not only am I being told that, you know, my own personal experience, which is, as far as I understand feminism, is like the most sacred cow of sacred cows in feminism. So you're leading your politics from your own experience. My experience doesn't matter because I don't understand it as well as someone who didn't have it.
You had an incorrect experience.
Exactly. I had an incorrect experience, and therefore I have an incorrect understanding of it. And who's going to correct me? Who's going to come in and save me from my false understanding of myself?
In this piece you did for Jacobin, you make the point that the web and things like that are making it possible to almost like normalize sex work, that it's just becoming kind of routine. It's not almost more democratic. I mean, it's cutting out a lot of middlemen and a lot of troublesome intermediaries. Why is that so risky?
I mean, it's risky for people who would like to keep sex work very marginal, and I think that's the question we need to ask. I believe that the true purpose of the criminalization of sex work is to keep it marginal, is to, you know, allow it to be this much more dangerous activity in order to scare people out of doing it. You know, I think just like laws prohibiting drug use, laws prohibiting many kinds of, you know, vices. That's the ideology behind it, is we're going to make the consequences of this so dire that people will not do it. There's absolutely nothing in anti-prostitution law that's of use to women that makes women's lives any safer. So if now we're in this moment, you know, about 100 years after, you know, most states have criminalized prostitution in some way, shape, or form, where you have the web, you have services like Craigslist, which are not just, you know, as people call it, an online red light district. Like, what's scary for people about Craigslist is you can buy anything there. You can buy a couch. You could rent an apartment. You could get a hand job. And they are all occupying the same level space, which is reality, right? Like, these are markets that touch each other and are interconnected.
I think there's a certain kind of leftist that say, you just made a point that you're commodifying sex, you're commodifying human relations, and there's something bad and alienating about that.
I don't believe that you can make that argument when we would not make a parallel argument about other kinds of labor that require our bodies to be present. Am I commodifying my hands when I type an email for someone? Am I commodifying my mind when I write a book and get paid almost nothing for it? What is the process in which my labor is actually being exploited? I don't think it's in the performance of the labor. I think it's in how I am treated in performing that labor. And what laws that criminalize prostitution do, and these campaigns to try to end these websites, making sex ads more available to people by making them free and sort of flattening the marketplace, what they are saying is, you doing this labor is the exploitation, not the situation in which you are doing the labor. And that's where I would break from that. I don't think it's particularly useful in talking about people's rights to talk about the exploitation of their labor only when it's this one part of their body and not the rest of their life. I could argue that what was actually exploitative about Craigslist is that when they were pressured by these anti-prostitution groups to take down the ads, their response was to institute a mandatory credit card charge for all of these ads, which they did not have for every ad on the website. It was the sex ads that you had to pay for. So now we have a discriminatory pricing model based on people's fears that prostitution is terrible. And then what does that open up? Now sex workers, and not other workers, have to turn over their credit card information to Craigslist, who now has a database of everyone who's placed a sex ad on the website in an environment where many of those ads might put people at legal risk. So I think that's very upsetting. So to me, the move to kind of take down a website like this or to criminalize this behavior has very little to do with respecting people's rights or autonomy. It's about controlling them and scaring them out of an activity that we would prefer they not do. There's no rights there at all.
That was Melissa Jarrett Grant, writer and sex work activist. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this from Sparks. Till next week, bye.